Bailey and Hardy, Ultrasound Assistant, is proudly sponsored by Protein Rebel. Have you ever had super twitchy legs, after a long run where you can't get to sleep and they're just like twitchy, twitchy, twitchy? I have. And the only thing that has ever sorted them out is this Protein Rebel Power Up Seawater Magnesium. All you need to do is take 1 teaspoon of Power Up every evening, mix with water or juice, and it helps to improve your sleep, it honestly does, reduce restless and twitchy legs, and power up your body ready for your next run. Protein Rebel are a UK-based company who provide natural nutrition for runners, and their products include marine collagen, which I've also tried, which is amazing, this magnesium, which is amazing, a vegan protein powder, and award-winning maple syrup gels. And they have been kind enough to gift me a bundle to give to you, dear listener. One lucky listener will win a bundle in September 2024. And that bundle includes a tin of Accelerate vegan protein powder, a tin of Run Easy marine collagen, a tin of Power Up seawater magnesium, and 9 of these delightful Maple Ignite energy gels. All you need to do, head to Instagram, go to our link tree, enter the competition. The link is in the link tree. Put your email in, Bob's your uncle, but this will only work in September 2024. I love Protein Rebel. I really, really do. They sent me stuff free to try, and then I started buying it. And you can buy it too, using a discount code, which is also in our bio on Instagram. You'll get 15% off. So head over to Instagram at Ultrasound System Pod, fill in the form, enter the competition, get your discount code. And remember, listener, this is a grown-up podcast for grown-up people with some very immature, silly themes and lots of swearing. So if you're in the car on the school run, I'd advise you fucking switch it off now. All the best. Welcome to the Bailey and Reed Ultrasound System. It's episode 76. I can't think of anything that rhymes with 76 that has anything to do with Tour de Géant, but maybe later in the podcast I will. So I'll just add it in and then you'll just pretend that it happened at the start. Me, Ali Bailey, and 50% of my co-host.
Kirsty Reed?
That's it.
Okay, I thought you'd forgotten.
No, 50% of my co-host. She's 50% of a human and 50% of a mountain. That's what happens when you go to Italy, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I think 50% of a human is fairly accurate given my levels of tiredness.
And then when you're running in the mountain, it creeps up to your body and you become half of it.
Yeah, I'm half Ibex now.
Yeah. Someone said to me they're not called Ibex, it's Ali. They're called chamois.
Chamois. I think that's two different things, Ibex and chamois.
That's what I wrong. Think as well. Yeah. But don't worry, we'll do an investigation into that later in the podcast. First things first, congratulations on being a giant of the Géants.
Thank you. Yeah. It's the first time I've ever been called a giant in my entire life.
What, even by like a small person?
Well, I am a small person.
We'll move on to hallucinations later. So spoiler alert, everyone. Sorry, this hasn't been very exciting. It's not like we've gone through the whole thing and then gone, oh, will she finish? Won't she finish? She did finish, actually. We all had a nice time. So this episode is going to be dedicated to Kirsty Reed and her Tour de Géant experience, which is something that, Jesus Christ, it was a race that I can't explain to you. So I'm going to leave it to Kirsty to explain it to you because it's just too fucking mental to be explained.
Okay.
It's fucking mental, isn't it?
Well, so Tour de Géant is a race in the Aosta Valley. It's 300 on paper, people. It's 330 kilometres with about 24,000 metres of ascent. It's a non-stop race, which means you start in Courmayeur, you do this enormous loop and you finish in Courmayeur. But there's no stages, so it's not like something like Dragon's Back or any of those other races where you kind of, this is day one's route, and then you stop and you camp and you have some nice bants and cups of tea and stuff. It literally, the clock never stops. So it's a race at the front where people will treat it as a race and they will go out as hard as they can and get back in 70 hours or whatever. And then the ultimate cutoff is 150 hours. So the bulk of the people are doing it as a kind of adventure, as an experience. And I was definitely in that. Along the way, it's a lot of mountain passes. It's very remote. It's quite, it's very runnable in places, but also very technical in other places. So what sets it apart, I guess, from a lot of races is that you have these sections where you'll kind of climb up a big ascent. You're going up to like say 3,000 meters, so that's like three times the size of something like Snowdon or Helvellyn or something like that. And you kind of climb, zigzags. Then you'll get to like a steeper bit, and then at the top it'll just be like the rock kind of summit where you have kind of ropes to hang on to. Then you have kind of what's called ferrata, which are these kind of metal bits that have been sunk into the rock to help people kind of get up. You might have heard of like via ferrata, which are kind of roots of those. So it's something that keeps you on your toes all the time. There's a lot of things that can kind of trip you up, literally and figuratively, and it's just a crazy, crazy, crazy adventure. So I guess like the most people would have heard of like the Tour of Mont Blanc or something like that, one of those kind of like classic kind of walking routes. I guess it's like that on a bigger scale, slightly more extreme. Everything's just a bit extra, I guess, to do all those things. But it is like just the most incredible adventure. And I was out there for 6 days. Was it 6 days? I don't know. I
No,
left on
what
the
you were out running or we were out on tour?
I was out running. I left on the Sunday morning, and I got back late
About
on the Friday night,
1 a.m. Saturday morning, you're back.
Saturday morning.
Yeah.
So there you go. It's like, it's that's kind of part of it as well. It's like that kind of mind, the stuff that messes with your mind. You don't know what day it is. You've been out there so long, it doesn't feel real. There's nothing to kind of break down the days. The only thing there is to kind of, help you kind of know where you are, I guess, in space and time, is there's six life bases along the way where you can have crew to kind of come and help. And those were, that's where you can sleep as well. And those were absolute kind of focuses. That's all you think about is like getting to the next one. I get to the next one, I can change my pants. I can get to the next one, and maybe they'll have a sandwich for me that isn't all of the stuff that's on the aid stations. So yeah, it's like a big, crazy adventure, chance in a lifetime, probably the biggest thing I'll ever do. That's all I can explain it as, really.
Why did you want
Why?
to do it?
It falls into the category of stuff that I've seen loads of my friends do and really looked at it and thought, wow, that's incredible, but I would never be good enough to do that. And I think sort of that's the pull of it for me. It always felt a little bit beyond the edges of what I could possibly do. And not in terms of being a fraud about it or whatever, because I work hard and I train hard and I put the work in. But I did just always think, I've seen, like James Elson, Debbie Martin Kansani, just like tons and tons of people that I know kind of do it and think, yeah, but they're so much better than me. They're a bit faster, like maybe I'd get cut off, like they're much better on technical terrain. So it's all those things, isn't it? You feel like I'd love to do that, but it's maybe just a bit too hard for me. And then just I guess just something clicked in me last year, and I thought, yeah, I think I did the Northern Traverse maybe. And obviously in the previous few years I'd done like stuff like Dragon's Back, and I thought, you know what, if I'm going to give it a go, it's now or never. Because it I'm 52. It gets harder every year. I'm not saying you can't do these things. Like, you absolutely can do them, but it's just going to be a little bit harder to do it every year. So I went for it. Yeah.
If the Northern Traverse had a baby with Dragon's Back and then the baby was pumped full of steroids and taken to Italy, that would be Tour de Géant.
Okay, I'll take your word for that. I couldn't quite follow that entire analogy. I think like one. I suppose. Dragon's Back would be the closest analogy for it in the UK, but obviously the summits are three times as high.
It's not though, is it? It's not an analogy for it. It's like comparing fucking a corner shop to John Lewis. Like it's just mental. Like I've never seen anything like it in my life. I just was like driving between checkpoints thinking they've got to go over the top of that. And it's just I don't think you can understand what a 3,000 meter mountain looks like till you've seen one, really, can you?
It really hurts your neck, doesn't it, to look at
It
that?
hurts your neck to look at it, and it makes you feel tired even when you're at the bottom, which is quite irritating for everybody. Talk us through it then. Talk us through it then. How? First off, let's talk about a little bit of training. How do you train for a race in Italy with those sort of ascents when there aren't those sort of ascents in the UK?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that is a problem, can't lie. But then you look at, like when Galen Reynolds went a few years ago, he was living in London. So, people do this all the time. So I live in the lakes, so I'm lucky the most, and I did a lot of hills. So every week it would be hill sessions, and those might vary from kind of short, sharp kind of hill sessions, like it might be like 10 times by 1 minute or something, right up to, three or four times by 15 minutes. So slogging uphill for like 15 minutes. Every long run I did was hilly. And I also did a week of training in Italy just to try and get used to what it feels like again, to do a 1,000 meter climb or to do a 1,500 meter climb all in one go. I did also did some altitude training at the body rehab in Staveley in the Lakes, which is a kind of a physio centre, but they offer all sorts of other facilities as well. So you've got a treadmill with a mask, and it pumps in this kind of mix of air that is supposed to be equivalent to 14,000 feet. So you know what it feels like to be breathing that thin air, because that is a massive part of this race. You spend a lot of the time up at altitude, and that is going to make breathing really hard. It's going to make you breathe a lot faster, lose a lot more moisture through your breath. It's just going to make everything feel harder. You're going to feel more fatigued. So it wasn't you. I couldn't really acclimatize for that, but it's making me realize what it's going to feel like. So I didn't really panic when it did feel like that. So I did a lot of like general running on there, but also a lot of hill sessions. So I'd crank the treadmill up to the biggest incline and then just hike for like 15, 30 minutes. So I'm pretty pleased that the preparation I did was right, but it's still, unless you live out there, it's still a shock. You get on that first climb and you just think, I'm climbing for like 3, 4 hours, I'm never good. This is so hard. I'm never gonna be able to do it. I'm never gonna be able to do it. And you panic and you panic and you panic, and then you get up to the top and you literally summit and you go, "This is the best thing ever."
That first day was a bit shit, wasn't it? Weather-wise, like it was very British.
Yeah, it was really rainy the first day.
So you come out of Courmayeur and then you go up that massive fucking hill over to Lathwil. In the pissing rain, when you're going up those massive climbs, do you stop? Like, do you just keep going? Because when I go, I do this thing where I stop and take a picture of the view, pretend I'm taking a photo for Instagram, but actually I'm just recovering. But is it just a case of keeping going until you get to the top, or is it like have a little break, let your heart rate go down? Does your heart rate go down at altitude?
No, I would have thought it'd be higher. Your heart rate would be higher altitude. So the first one was weird. So you run around Chamonix. Oh God, kill me now. You run around Courmayeur to a little lap, don't you? And everyone waves, and everyone's so nervous. And that's worth saying, actually. It's really not a race for banter. If you enjoy banter, no one's going to talk to you because they're all terrified. And then you literally, we kind of came to the bottom of the first climb and everyone stopped. And I thought, shit, it's been an accident. This is like this huge queue of people. But no, it was a queue of people because there's like about, I guess, about 400 or 500 people in my start. And we just stood there for 10 minutes waiting to get on to, even on to the first climb. So that, I mean, in a way, that was annoying. But then at the same time, it sort of helped settle your nerves a bit. So then we started climbing, and because you're all kind of quite close together, like no one's stopping on that one. So on that first one, definitely didn't stop. It was more kind of like, I don't want to be in people's way or like, that sort of stuff. So on the first couple, probably not, but as it got on, yes, absolutely, 100%. So like by the sort of second half of the first day and into the second day, like I was really sort of suffering with the altitude, just feeling really nauseous, like not able to get like food and water in, and everybody else felt the same. It's nothing, I'm not special, but because of that, I was kind of having to set myself little goals. So I'd sort of say, right, do 5 switchbacks and then stop and have a 30-second reset, 5 switchbacks, and then when I was feeling like absolutely at my worst, I do a lot of counting steps on a sense. So I'd count, like generally I'll count up to 100, and then if I need a little rest, I'll stop. But on when it was really bad, I was like counting 20 steps. I was like, do 20 steps and then have a little rest.
I did that in Mongolia, completely the opposite, because it was so flat I couldn't bear it anymore. So I was counting the steps. And I was like, once you've counted the steps, you're allowed to look up. It was like little treats, like looking up.
That's exactly it. It was little treats. like that. And yeah, just like once I get to that point up there, I'm gonna have like my frutella.
Oh, how
You know.
exciting. We're going to talk about that in a bit, like the things that you have in your bag that start off as being wonderful and end up as being the worst thing you've ever put in your fucking mouth. So yeah, let's talk about one of the things I found quite interesting about it was the weather, in that I've been told a lot about how the weather changes, because obviously it's a mountain range, isn't it? But I
Yeah.
wasn't quite prepared for the, it was 36 degrees when we left Donas, one of the checkpoints, which is just before the halfway point. Donas, it's in a valley, so it's quite low. There's no wind. It's boiling fucking hot. You see, like, sweat is dripping off your head. And then a day and a half later, it's minus 10 and you're like battling a snowstorm. Like, that's mental. So how was that for you? Like, how, because obviously that sounds like you've got to carry kit for all weathers, which you don't particularly want to do you?
No, I mean I'm like you. I'm quite like conservative on the kit. Like I will err on the side of caution like every single time. So I always had a lot of kit in my bag, as you know. But yeah, it was really hard that actually. Like even on the warmer days, like the nights were really, really cold. So I just knew that I had to just bundle up. So I was like two like couple of base layers, couple of jackets, couple of pairs of gloves. Just bundled up on the nights, and you just kind of get through them, sort of thing. I think Donas was the only time I was warm. I
It
spent,
was so fucking hot in Donas. It was
yeah.
like being at Club Tropicana. I loved it. I was like, this is amazing. I thought I'm going to get suntan. It was
Yeah.
delightful, but it was not delightful for runners.
No, well, I didn't mind it actually. I didn't mind it because it was just, if it had been like that the whole time, I think that would have been really difficult. But no, it was yeah, no, it was all right. But the stuff that I found really hard was the final day. I'm trying to think now. The final day we had snow, and initially it was kind of like, oh, snow! Oh, this is exciting, isn't it? Great to get snow in the mountains. And then as it got worse, it was just like, oh fuck, this is going to make going really slow. The wind really got up, so it's really difficult to stay warm. But all of those things were kind of fine until we got to the last climb, which is up to this summit called Malatra. And you kind of get up to it. There's like a hut up there, Hut Frusanti or something like that. And like it's getting increasingly windy as you get up there, and the snow is like blowing like right into your face and everything. And you think, oh, this isn't that much fun. And you hear a lot about this final summit that it's really tricky. So I started to sort of think, oh, maybe they're gonna cut this summit off because they
We
did.
had There were whispers in the valley that if it that they were going to stop race. There was
Yeah.
whispers in the valley, and it was like, what?
Yeah.
Because everybody had worked so hard to that point. I must have been at probably Friday morning, Thursday afternoon. It was like rolling through all of the support crews down in Courmayeur. They're going to stop the race, going to stop the race. And it was like, fucking don't say anything to anybody.
Yeah. So I went into the hut, like these it's worth saying actually the mountain huts and the refuges and stuff are like just the absolute highlight of the race. They're all like completely individual, run by volunteers, just absolutely beautiful, and they look after you like incredibly well, giving you soup and coffee and stuff like that. And I went into the hut and I just went, I said, is it safe to do this final thing? And the woman just goes, it's over there, it's a grade 4 scramble. And I was like, I really hope that doesn't mean the same as it does in the UK.
I really hope this has been lost in translation.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was really worried about this, and you kind of from the hut you go over this kind of long, kind of flattish kind of like summit bit, and the wind was, and the wind's blowing so hard that you can't breathe. So I was like, had my jacket zipped up and like my Innovate thing like right in front of my face, just and I was like ice spikes on because it had got really icy. That was my main concern, and I was just terrified at this point, and I just thought, what the fuck am I going to do if I cannot make it over this scramble? Unfortunately, I was with somebody. I was with this American woman called Rachel, who's pretty much the only person I spoke to in the entire race, who was really nice, like super interesting, and we just did it together. We were both like really scared, but we did it together. And you went over, then you went along this kind of like skinny little traverse, which was fine but icy, so you were digging your ice spikes in. Then you start the climb up onto this last little summit, and it's a sort of really steep zigzaggy bit, and that was the worst bit. Like you couldn't get any purchase because it was ice on rock, and you just couldn't get any purchase on it. And then as you got up higher, you got a rope. So I was like hanging on to the rope with one hand, like just trying to like sort of stay safe. And then once we got over there, honestly, that was the scariest part of the whole race for me. You know, you've been awake for 5 days, pretty much. Your legs are shot. You know, but it was that ab like absolute abject terror. Like couldn't breathe. Like it was ho horrible, horrible,
Do
horrible.
they, how do they know you've been over those summits? Do you have to dib in?
Yeah, well, most of them had to dib in. They have these
Did
little
you?
well, you've got this thing on your wrist,
Yeah, it's a
and it's got
hospital
a chip in.
bracelet.
Yeah, with a chip in. Most of you had to dib in. And on some of those summits, they have this, you know, you have those little, basically like a little glass box that someone
Wow.
stands in. Yeah. So there was a guy in a little glass box, but he didn't make you dib in. So I don't know how they knew you over
What? Are you sure there was a man in the glass box, or were you just imagining that?
that.
How
No,
do they do this? Like, how do they put these people up there? That's one of the things I'm like, my mind is blown. You know, people kept talking about there's two men in a hut here, there's this person here, there's that person there, there's flags marking the entire fucking route. Someone has put those flags
yeah.
out, someone will take those flags in. Like,
Yeah, mind blown.
it's mental because it's fucking scary, isn't it? And it's like so that last climb was, what would you compare that to in the UK? Because it's really hard to imagine it.
Oh gosh. Yeah, I don't
Was it like
know.
an icy Helvellyn, icy Swirl's Edge, or icy Crib Goc, or like icy Snowdon?
It wasn't like an edge. It was it'd be something where like the top, I don't know, the top 50 meters is like a scramble.
Yeah, like Penigent. You know how Penigent, it's got that, like you come up Penigent and it's like sheer, and it's like you're, if it's wet, it's terrifying because it's not very high. Well, it's quite high, but it's just rock in front of you, so you are literally all fours having to get up it. And then
Yeah.
when you get over the top, you kind of throw yourself over the top. You're like, oh, thank God for that. You're back on the flat
Yeah.
again. Yeah, that sounds horrible. And I think when you're that tired, it's not that much fun, is it?
Yeah. Well, weirdly, the tiredness dissipated with the terror.
Oh, that's good. That's, or you think the tiredness dissipates with the terror. You're so
Yeah.
tired. Okay, so what was there any point where you were like, I can't do this? Was there
No.
any point where you had to pull the plug?
No, the only point that I thought the plug would be pulled with that was that last descent, because I didn't think I was going to be able to do it. But no, there was that, like, I wanted to do that race so much that there was no point at which I ever thought about stopping, which I don't think I could say for many races. But yeah, I mean, there were times when I thought, like, I'm really tired. You know, I don't know whether I'm going to be able to stay ahead of the cutoffs and stuff like that. But actually, the cutoffs weren't a problem at all. But there was no point at which I wanted to stop. No. No.
Well, how much sleep did you get? I'm quick firing questions that I know that people want the answers to. So, how much sleep do you have? You added it up?
I haven't added it up, but I can do it now. So I didn't sleep the first night. Then I slept 90 minutes in whatever the second life base was.
I shall get my map out. But it is here, sitting in front of me.
I think it was Val something, Val
Val
Gus.
Gersonche.
Yeah, so I slept 90 minutes there. And when you sleep, it's like they have like camp beds, sort of in the checkpoint. So they're in a building or like in a marquee sort of thing. So they could be kind of like nice and quiet in a building, or they could be like horrible, drafty, and noisy in a marquee. So 90 minutes there. Then I did. I've slept at a
Konya,
ref. Sorry?
Konya, in Konya you had a little nap.
Did I?
Yeah, you did. You went. You had a whole pizza, and then you had a nap.
Did I?
Yeah, I gave you the whole pizza. You ate all of it. I thought, well, this is going to be okay because you'll leave half of this. I can have it for my dinner. And you selfishly ate all of
Okay,
it.
so I didn't sleep at Val Gresynch then. I think I just slept at Konya.
Dokie. That's 90 minutes still in the
So
pot.
90 minutes at Konya. Didn't sleep at Donas,
No, because
but
it was possible with balls.
I had 60 minutes at a refuge. We're in a bed. Oh my God, in a
What with a
bunk bed.
duvet?
No, with a blanket. They always give you a scratchy blanket. But I had to. The difficult part was, and this might strike terror into anyone going to your workshop this weekend, is they just gave me a blanket and they said, top bunk in there is free, and then closed the door and it was completely pitch black. So I had to like
It's like
feel,
a
didn't have my phone or anything with me because it was
Which
charging.
top bunk?
So I had to feel my way along and to see, just to see if there's anyone in a bunk. Anyway,
That
60 minutes.
is so much fun. That is so much fun. I bet the person on that checkpoint was like, I'm bored. I know what we're going to do. We're going to make a fun game. There's probably an infrared camera in there.
But
The game's
that
called Top Bunk is Free.
was that's probably the best sleep that I had, I think.
Because it was with someone else, spooning someone else.
quite possibly, yeah, we're married now. 6 minutes there, then I had a where'd I have another? I had my emergency sleep, didn't I, when I was wandering around, didn't know who I was.
Yeah.
That was 60
Down
minutes.
to that. So you got Donas, you went through Donas, and you. Oh, what about Grassinney? Did you sleep at Grassinney? That's like. Grassinney
Yeah.
is pretty much. It's not halfway, but it is like the halfway big checkpoint.
Yeah, I think Grassinney was where I ate the best sandwich I've ever had in my entire life. So I probably wouldn't have slept after that because I'd have been too excited about that sandwich.
Then you've got Val Tenace. That's the next big checkpoint, the next life base. I think you did
God.
have a sleep there. I think you had a sleep at Val Tenace because you had a kip and then you went on to Oyes. You didn't have a kip at Oyes.
Okay. Oh,
But I don't know.
yeah. So I
But
had,
90 or 60 minutes at Val Tenace,
I think I had 60 minutes there and then I pushed through to Olymon, didn't I? For a bigger sleep. Oh, no, I had 30 minutes. I had 30 minutes there and then 90 minutes at Olymon. So let's see what is. That's all of it. So that's, one, two, 5 hours 30, I reckon.
In basically what was always 6 days.
Well, yeah, but a lot of people will have probably slept 1 hour,
Doesn't
if
really
that.
matter. I still think it's fucking bad. I still think it's fucking bad. So yes, amazing sleeps. Let's talk about so you're going to do massive like long slogs, like hours, like 7 or 8 hours without seeing anyone, right?
Yeah.
What were you thinking? How did you do that? Like, what did you do to entertain yourself?
well, as you know, I like the A to Zs. I like my A to Zs. So I will to occupy my mind, I will do like an A to Z of everything I've seen that day.
Oh, and
So,
he's said of everything you've seen. That's exciting. I've never done that before.
well, not everything I've seen, but just like something for A. So that might be I saw Ali at the aid station. B might be I don't know.
Bellends.
I saw some bellends. Did see quite a few bellends. Yeah, so I go through and I do that. I work my way through that. That occupies your mind pretty well. I had some audio books. I had some music, but I really tried to save those for like a treat. I tried to save those for like middle of the night, like just wanted something to help me through. It wasn't like I say, it wasn't a chatty race, like only chatted to a couple of people the whole way through.
Did you ever try and chat to someone and they were just like, no?
Yeah, everyone.
Oh, I
Pretty
don't think
much
I would have
everyone.
liked that. I would have got quite upset about
You did chat to people, the very short-lived chats.
that.
So like people would come up to me and they'd go, "Ah, you are English. Have you done the spine race?"
Oh, yes.
And to be honest, I wouldn't have wanted that much chit chat. It was only really the last day that I was kind of feeling chit chatty. But yeah, I mean, most of the time, like you're occupying your mind with thinking about, like, I've got to get to this aid station. I did a lot of stressing about times. So a lot of the time,
Mathletics, stressful mathletics.
well, not really mathletics, but
Well,
more,
Vordermaths. So, me and my friend Lily used to call it Vordermaths, where suddenly
yeah.
you turn into Carol Vorderman, but you're not because you haven't got the skills, and you start to get be like, well, it's 14 kilometres there, minus 6 there, and then you take into account the ascent there, then you've got 465. That's number one.
More number one. So the first couple of days they went really quickly and like it was really easy. Well, not really easy, but like you could get quite a lot of mileage under your belt. And then all of a sudden, like the sort of middle sections, there was just a lot of kind of technical descending, boulder fields, stuff like that, where it was just such slow going. And you kind of look at your watch and you go, "Oh, it's taken me an hour to cover that mile." Like
There is
literally.
nothing worse than looking at your watch and thinking, I think the numbers on my watch are going backwards. Like, what the fuck?
It was really dispiriting, and then I started to really worry about stuff, and then that kind of led me to, like, I got into an aid station. I really should have slept, but I was so stressed about time that in my head I just thought I'll get this next section under my belt, and then I'll be happy to sleep. Because I always have, I think in any race, like even in park run, I've got a thing about getting to halfway. Once I get to halfway, I relax a bit,
Me too.
and then I then it's kind of like feels much more achievable somehow. It feels like.
The irony is, you get to halfway, and I always think I've really broken the back of this. Like, I'm really like, but then that quarter from halfway to like a quarter of the way to the end is the slowest, horriblest, hardest bit, and seems to take twice as long as the first half has taken. Why is that?
Yeah, don't know. Don't know the answer to that. It's got to be psychological,
It's
hasn't
got to
it?
be fatigue related, isn't it?
Yeah. But it did, like, it really, the absolute sort of distance of it really kind of messed with your head. And much as I felt like I was psychologically prepared for it, it's just like it is what it is. You know, it's 300 kilometres, or it came out on my watch as 220 miles actually in the end.
That's what I think. Damien got 224.
Oh, well, he ran further than me because he's better.
He didn't run further. He just probably got lost because he's rubbish at that. Sorry, Damien.
Yeah, just I really sort of tried to just break it down into sort of base life base to life base and not think about the enormity of it. But every once in a while, you sort of got to halfway at like 1 o'clock in the morning or something, and I really congratulated myself. I was like, "Come on, you're doing really well." Then you sort of think, "Fuck, there's such a long way to go," and it's sort of like it's just a constant kind of battle, I think, in your head. But
Did you find the sleep magical in the sense that, when you're having like, it's all very dramatic and you're like, oh my God, I've got so far to go. I can't possibly do what I've just done again. I always think that, can you do what you've done again? And then you have the sleep and it reframes everything. It's like quite an incredible thing, sleep, isn't it? Did you find that, or did you find it made it better, or did you find it made it worse? Did you hit a sweet spot of like, this is my amount of sleep?
Definitely. Like, sleep felt like the most beautiful thing in the world. Like, honestly, felt like when I finished, it's like, I don't need to sleep anymore. I'll just sleep for 90 minutes a night and it'll just be amazing. But yeah, it de def sleep definitely kind of reset quite a lot. Yeah, just I think like the rest more than anything, just lying down and not being like in movement for like half an hour or whatever. And it's just amazing, like a really, I have definitely haven't cracked the sleep and I want to look at it a lot more, but it is amazing how you can be like drop down fatigued. Like there were times when I was, as like, well, maybe we'll talk about that, like struggling like mentally to even know where I was. And then you have a little sleep and you're just like, wow, I feel good as new again. Oh, look, my legs are all right. Oh yeah, my stomach feels a lot better. So yeah, it was like really magical. And there was, like the trail, this is the first time I've ever done trail naps. And like when I was absolutely just falling down asleep, I just lie down on a rock, then set my alarm for 5 minutes, and then you just reset like enough of your kind of sleep. Like Robbie, my coach, explained it to me. It's like as you're getting more and more fatigued, you're building up a chemical in your brain that is what makes you tired. And like in the initial stages of a race, you can sleep for an hour and a half, and then that'll reset it, and you'll get another day of feeling okay. But then as the race goes up, that chemical builds up and up and up, and you can sleep for 5 minutes or sleep half an hour, whatever, reset it a little bit, but you're going to get diminishing returns on it. So I kept thinking about that. I kept thinking in the latter stages, it's like it's really tempting to kind of push through, but actually all you're doing is making it harder for yourself in the later stages. So if I had half an hour now, I'll buy myself another 5 6 hours of feeling all right, and then I can get here, and then I can have a proper sleep, reset myself for another 7 8 hours of doing stuff. So it's really interesting. I'm no expert, but it's really interesting.
It is, and it's very much a individual thing. There's quite a lot of arguments around sleep that I have with people where they're like, that's not a nap, that's a sleep. And it's like, but I think it really depends on the person and how there's a definite difference between elite level athletes and the general population. 100%, they're doing 10 minutes, whereas I'm like, nah, it's got to be, if it's going to be decent for me, it has to be 90 minutes. Mine is a 90 minute cycle, and I learned that on the on the wild horse. Like, I built it up to the deficit where I was like, I have 3 hours in the car. But I also know that 3 hours is like a whole night's sleep on one of those races. It's like a complete reset. And I think, as well as being a really good tool in ultra running, it's also a good tool to understand in life, isn't it? But if things are really fucking hard, a sleep can honestly reset the whole game, even a 90-minute sleep. So, but it is a very, very personal thing, and I'm not sure. There's so many studies on it. You've got to go through a whole cycle. Don't go through a whole cycle. It's either 20 minutes or 90 minutes. You can't do 60 minutes, but you just got to learn by doing it, haven't you?
Yeah, definitely. And two things on that thing, like the 90 minutes thing. Like I found that to be really true. So a 90-minute full cycle makes you feel really good. But in some of the refuges, a six like you only allowed the bed for 60 minutes because it had lots of runners coming in, so they
Oh,
would
yeah.
limit you. And a 60-minute sleep made me feel horrible.
Same.
But then the other thing to say on that as well is like if you want to have a 30-minute sleep or a 40-minute sleep, whatever, you've got to lie down for 45 minutes because you're going to get settled. It's going to take you 5 minutes to get to sleep. You know, so it's like. I think Robbie said to me, "Don't just lie down for 30 minutes sleep because actually all you're going to do is get 20 minutes, and that's not going to be enough. So lie down 40, get 30."
But even like 10 minutes can help. Like on the spine, I did that 10 minutes at Malham, and I thought it was going to be 20, but I woke up after 10, and I was like straight up. Like it just is almost like it's like emptying a sink of dirty water, putting the plug back in, and filling it up again. That's literally how it felt. It's sleep is very, very a very interesting thing. But I think the worst thing is building up that debt of sleep where. I mean, if you look at, we'll talk. I'm going to talk to Damien next week, so we'll talk about the front of the race then. But John Kelly fucked it by not having that sleep. Like he just was so excited about everything that he ended up not sleeping, and then he ended up because he wasn't sleeping, he started to feel tired, and then he stopped eating, and that's it. He stopped eating. So when he got to a refuge and managed to have a table sleep, woke up, still hadn't eaten, and basically it just starts to unravel, doesn't it? How was your eating? Were you really militant about eating?
No, my eating was terrible. It was like my biggest flaw, really. Yeah, it's interesting what you're saying there because you have to, it's spinning plates, isn't it? And the minute you take your eye off one plate, all the other plates go. And that was definitely the case with me. I think I said to you, like the thing that kept going through my head was like everyone has a plan until we get punched in the face. Like just,
Literally what the lad said to me at the front. Literally what John said. Literally like what they all said. Like it was like, hey, I had this great plan, and then it all fucking went wrong. It's like, yeah.
but I think, and Robbie had said that to me before. Like he said it's good to have a plan, but don't be wedded to that plan because you are just going to have challenge after challenge after challenge. So it's better to be. Okay, I'm going to eat this now, or I'm going to sleep here, or whatever, when you really, really need it, then rather than trying to stick to what you're going to do, because like there's so many moving parts in a race like this. But with my nutrition, I had a really good plan. I sat down with Rena McGregor, friend of us,
Also,
anyway.
we had Renee on speed dial. She was voice noting me while you were running to tell me what to get you and to make sure that you're okay. It was like you were an elite athlete. He had a full squad.
No, like Rini's a friend of mine, and she'd helped me, which was really kind. And so we had this kind of plan, and it was like a mix of like liquid calories. It was chews. It was there was some gels in there for some
What
emergencies.
was that fucking shake you had that
Oh
smelled
yeah.
pink? It was absolutely, it was like Pepto-Bismol mixed with Sprite. It fucking was disgusting.
That's a strawberry flavour.
I don't fancy
It
that.
was a Beta Fuel. Recovery shake, and it's a mix of it's like equal parts carbohydrate and protein. So the idea was it would give me a reset, help my muscles etc. recover whilst I was kind of at the aid at the base life bases, but also kind of give me energy as well for when I wanted to get going. So I stand by it. I think it was a really good idea, and I did get most of it down at every life
The
base, and I
funniest
thought
thing was when you
it
didn't get it
helped.
down, and I was like, I need you to get the rest of this down. Then I took the lid off, smelt it, was like, no, it's okay, you don't need to drink that. It's fucking disgusting.
Well, it was, but I mean, other flavors are available. But no, I think I do think that was a really good idea, and I think it would be a good idea if you were doing a big multi-day. Some sort of drink with a mix of carbohydrate and
I'm obsessed with,
protein.
I was obsessed with Mountain Fuel Morning Fuel for a while, which is like that. So, put some, I was putting oat milk in it and then shake it up. And it was just like liquid porridge, basically. I had carbs and protein in it. I fucking loved it. So I think they are a really good idea because also when you can't chew anymore or if you're in a rush, yeah, that's a good idea. It just was weird. Will you ever drink it again, do you think? Could you ever smell it again?
We're still got half a bag of it, so yes, I will.
Yeah.
It cost me like 60 quid. But yeah, generally on nutrition, I had a really good plan. Then, as happens to every single ultra runner and every single race, you start to feel sick, and then it's kind of like, how do you deal with that? And I would say, like, I do suffer from nausea quite a lot, but this was like another level for me. This was like vomiting, and it was just horrible. You're just like on your knees, and you just think, I'm gonna die, I'm gonna die, I'm gonna die. It was that kind of vomiting, and I think looking back on it now, I was so panicked about that. I felt so I left Reenie a voice note straight away and said, Reenie, feeling really bad. I don't know what to do. What can I eat? What can I eat to feel better? So I got really obsessed with that there was some magic bullet, right? Which we and we all know there's no magic bullets in anything, right?
No.
So I wanted really to just say, like, buy this specific thing, and then this will make you feel all right. But in actual fact, what Rini said to me, which is really really true, was that you are operating at altitude, which is going to make you feel sick. It's also going to make you breathe a lot harder. Your respiration rate is going to be a lot harder. That means you're losing a lot more moisture. So look at whether or not you're taking on enough liquid. Then you're also like really exerting yourself over a really long period and you're really tired. So what you're feeling is a mix of all those things. It isn't like a magic bullet of eat a ginger chew and you'll feel better. It is,
A
it was
vial of unicorn tears.
exactly.
Wonders.
It was a case of I had to get back on top of my hydration. So then it was like putting more. I had like electrolyte, precision hydration electrolytes. It was taking on more of those. It was taking on more liquid than I had, because obviously when you feel sick, you stop drinking liquid. It was nibbling on, like Rini said, like get things like sweets. And then obviously Rini left you a message to get me stuff like ginger beer, lemonade, anything like that.
Tomatoes and salt. I went down the boiled egg and salt route. I thought that might work.
Yeah.
But yeah, the thing is, it's basically you'll get so desperate, don't you? You get desperate for a solution, but there isn't one. The
Yeah.
solution's time. That's the solution.
Yeah, the solution is like you think okay, I can 100% just do this one thing and it'll make the solution, but the solution is 5% or 10% of all of the things that you're doing. You just got to kind of put right, and I think that's kind of like a good lesson in running, isn't it? It's like we're so quick to think, oh, I'm not doing enough mileage, or I'm not doing enough of this or that. And actually, the answer is probably do a little bit more of this, sleep a little bit more, do knock back the long runs, or do you know what I mean? It's probably like the solution is like 10 things rather than one magic bullet. And that was a really good lesson. But yeah, so it's like it was really hard to get back on top of the nutrition, but I feel like I did to a certain degree, but not very well. But then I think my lowest point was because I'd had sickness day one, sickness day two, then I really thought like cracked it. And then on day three, suddenly started being sick again. And that was like my lowest point, I think. And I think I left you a voice note. But no, still a lot of work. It's like I kept thinking during the race, like I've been running, doing ultras for so long, but actually I've got so much to learn.
What
Still
about
got so
pooing?
much
What
to learn.
about the poo? Did the poo happen? Was there lots of was there any poo problems, or was it just coming out the front end?
Sorry, just having a drink.
She's got a Rubicon, everybody. It's a still one. Not, it's not
No,
Rubicon Raw.
it's a Rubicon bottle, which has got like an electrolyte tablet. Because I'm still, however many days after, still trying to get on top of my hydration. But well, I had one kind of quite unpleasant poo incident, which was, I think it was like the second day when I'd been being sick and stuff. My stomach was just in, like a horrible state. And you sort of think, oh, I really need to go now. It has to be right now. So
You know that song Right Here, Right Now by Fatboy Slim? That's what that song is about.
So I saw this wall. There was like a field, and this wall. There were lots of people around at this point. I don't know why. So I jumped over the wall, dropped my pack, and then I kind of like disappeared into the undergrowth. And then I saw a farmer just in the field, right? So I thought, oh, shit, I'm gonna have to get a little bit more out of the way here. So then I kind of like walked a little bit further along, like got a bit deeper into the undergrowth, went in, did my business, all fine, and then I came out and I could not find where I dropped my backpack. I just dropped it like randomly over the wall, and because everything looked the same, it was just like undergrowth and wall. I couldn't work out where it was at all. So then I had to do like this kind of like forensic level investigation into like walking back and forth, like doing a fingertip search to try and find my backpack. And then I wasted about 10 minutes. Honestly, I was crying, and I thought, "This is it. I'm out of the race. I'm out of the race because I've lost my backpack." And then I finally found it. I was like, oh, thank God for that. And then I went, where did I put my poles?
Oh
So
no.
but then the funniest thing about that was literally carried it on up, got back over the wall, carried on up the wall for like up the road for 2 minutes, and there was an aid station with a port-a-loo.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
I know.
It's so annoying.
Yeah.
It's
But
so
yeah, that was
annoying.
the only sort of bad experience, I think.
That's my idea of hell is being on one of those races where it's like, that's it, you can't. That happens. That's I don't tend to throw up. It tends to be the other way around, which is bad. Anywho, I've got a couple of quick ones. Good dogs. How many good dogs did you see, and where were they?
Oh, so many good dogs. So I saw lots of good farm dogs, like really big, scruffy farm dogs, but like super friendly. Lots of the refuges, they had dogs. In lots of the like villages and towns and stuff, just lovely dogs. And I took the time to pet every dog. That
Good.
would be my tip. And but the best good dogs that I saw were my good friend Natalie had done the race and dropped out, and then. Really kindly came over to the finish. She lives in the area, but still a couple of hours drive away. Came over to the finish to see me come in, which I mean that takes a big person, doesn't it, when they've dropped out of their race. And brought her two lovely dogs, Rosa and Pika. So like Rosa and Pika were like the just like the highlight of the finish for me. So they're two very good dogs.
Other good pets that you saw on the route.
Oh, good. Well, when we say pets, we're talking general wildlife.
Potential pets to take home.
Okay, well, I found an ibex for Pickle, didn't I?
Yep, you did.
It
It
was
was
just hide.
Barris.
Yeah, it was hiding in the. I saw it out of the corner of my eye, and I was like, "That's an ibex. It's really close. What's
Yeah,
it
I felt like you sent me that picture to prove that you weren't going mental.
doing?" Yeah. Yeah, lots of ibex, like fields of ibex and stuff like that. It was really stunning. And a marmot. I saw a marmot. I was walking along, and there was like a sort of old farm building, dilapidated farm building, and I just saw this thing scurry out. They're about the size of a, I suppose, a small badger.
They're so cute. I didn't get to see one. Like I was running when I was going out on my runs. I was shouting, "Mom, mom, come out here!" So that's probably why. But they are so cute.
That could be it. You have to say that, but in Italian.
Marmotte, marmotte, like that.
So I saw tons and tons of amazing wildlife. It's incredible for that, like birds and you just hear it all the time. Just hear it all chirping around you and stuff. It's amazing.
Hallucination stations. Any good
Oh, mate.
ones? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, not great hallucinations, but. Like the worst point of the whole race for me was I think it was like the fourth night. So you're following these yellow flags, these little yellow flags. As you said, the whole thing is marked. It's absolutely incredible. And I was really tired, and it was the night when I'd made the mistake. I should have slept, but I went out. And it turned out to be a really hard section. So I'm wandering along, and I'm following these like yellow flags. And all of a sudden, I have literally got no idea who I am, where I am, what I'm doing. I'm just standing in the middle of a path, like there's no one around, middle of the night, and I'm thinking, all I know is about yellow flags. And it was the weirdest experience I've ever had. So I went up to this yellow flag, and I just looked at it, and it said Tour de Gion on it. And I was like, that's a race. Could I be in a race? And I looked at my clothes, and I was like wearing high, I was wearing like waterproof trousers and jacket at the time, and I thought, well, I'm not in a running race, so what am I doing here? And I thought, oh, I literally went, oh, Tour de Gion is in Italy. Could I be in Italy? And honestly, it's the strangest experience. Like I'd sat down a wall and tried to get my head together, and I just couldn't. I just couldn't. Didn't know who I was with. If I'd known who I was with, I would have 100% called them and gotten to and DNF'd, because it was really scary. It was like it's like I'd had some sort of like knock on the head or something,
It's an
and.
out of body experience. I'm sure it's your brain trying to protect you. You have an out of this out of body experience where it's like you're looking at yourself, but you can't do anything. It's almost like locked in syndrome.
But yeah, I just couldn't make sense of anything. And then so I kept all I knew was it was yellow flags, so I just kept walking and following the yellow flags. And fortunately, within about 3 or 4 miles, I came to this town where there was an aid station where you could sleep. So I slept, and then I was fine. But it was a really scary experience, and it made me not want to get too tired again. So I was a bit more careful the next couple of nights. Can't remember what the question was again about or
Hallucinations.
hallucinations. So, but generally, hallucinations, I mean, they start benign, don't they? They start like, oh, there's somebody on the side of the
Yeah, they
road.
start with, "Oh, look at that cat. Oh, there's a thing there. Oh, look at that. What's that?" Yeah.
And I see like on the rocks, I see words. So I'd see like Michael Palin, like on a. I can't explain it. Or like words off bases. It's like every rock had something painted on it, sort of thing. But then when they got bad, it was those Pierrot clowns. Do you remember
Yeah,
those?
no, I'm not into those. That would have, I wouldn't have
Like
liked that. How many of them were there? What
80s.
were they doing?
Oh, hundreds of them. Just like anything inside the road just became them. Small people. Oh, what are the other things I hallucinated? I was running with somebody who was seeing devils.
Fuck's
So like,
sake.
I was like, I'm all right with mine. But no, nothing really terrible, but
Yeah, I
it was
think you
basically.
told me that you were like, "Oh, look at those beautiful flowers in that field, hundreds of yellow flowers," and then
Oh
they turned
yeah.
into like just tall flags, like waving.
Yeah, there was one point where I came out of a refuge and I came down this path and I was following what I thought was tall flags into a field and it was actually just wildflowers. But yeah, that's the thing, you don't want to hallucinate on a race like that. But no, nothing really bad. I'd say I probably got away with it quite easily.
Right, and then I've got two more things to ask you. First thing is, how do you feel about finishing it? Like, what are your feelings? How do you feel? Are you like how like I don't want to put words in your mouth, but like there's lots of different ways to feel when you when it's a race that you've wanted to do your entire running life. When did you know you were finished, and how did you feel when you finished?
I it's a weird one. Like, I never had any doubt I was going to finish, and like from quite early on, I was quite tearful, thinking like, "Oh my God, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this." And I was really like kind to myself, like really, just sort of talking to myself, saying, "Oh, you're doing really well. Come on, you're going to do this. You're doing a really great job," sort of thing, which is quite unusual for me because I'm usually an absolute arsehole to myself. And then I suppose. When I got into maybe the final day, I thought, right, this is it. Nothing's going to derail this now. And the last, so I ran maybe two kind of biggest stretches of that final day with Rachel, and but then the last maybe 3 hours, I was on my own, I think, and that was a really good time because that was really like you could really start to sort of absorb it, like the enormity of the achievement, sort of thing. Listen to me, eh?
No, that's
But
completely what we want to hear because that's what it is. So after this, I want to talk to you about like people's perception of this race. Like the
right.
enormity of the achievement is exactly right. It's fucking mad.
Yeah. And I think one thing I felt really proud about was the fact that I'm 52, and that I've been I've done my biggest adventure at this age. Do you know what I mean? I'm not gonna look back and go, "Oh, when I was younger, I did this," or whatever. It's like
Well,
I
let's face
want.
it, when you were young, it was always easier, wasn't it? Like Dragon's Back was only like 2 days long,
Yeah.
and like London Marathon was only 10K, so.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. But I do feel really strongly that it's not it shouldn't be looked upon that it's like an unusual thing. I've got a lot of friends who are in their 50s and they're like, "Oh gosh, I can't run a 5K. All my knees have gone. Oh, I really struggle." And I think it should be the norm that we sort of celebrate that people do these things in their 50s. It shouldn't be like in the in the mirror or whatever. I started ultra running when I was 50, and this is what I learned. It's like I look around me in races like that, and I see women who are a lot older than me and men who are a lot older than me, and I find that incredibly inspiring. So anyway, I felt very proud to have done it, and I felt really, really tearful. I honestly thought I was gonna like collapse into like just patheticness on the line. But what happened was I get all of that emotion out of the way like in the last couple of miles, and then I came down that horrible steep technical fucking descent out of Courmayeur and just kept falling over and like breaking my knees. So then I just felt quite angry when I got in. So that took away all that upset. But I felt, yeah, incredibly proud. It didn't feel real. Like it still doesn't really feel real that I've managed to do it. Yeah, and I feel super proud.
Yeah, it's I do that as well. I go the last couple of miles, I will have a cry at the I think at the World Horse. I went into the public toilets and just cried for like a minute, probably like was like, okay, let's go. I've totally pulled myself together now. Yeah, I mean, we were all just so we all knew you could do it. It wasn't even like a thing of like she won't do it, but it was just every day as the days went on, the more of the course that you could see, or the more of the stories that you heard. The more mental it got, like the more Mad Max it got. And it's beyond
the understanding of anyone. I mean, I'd never been to Italy, so when I got there, I was like, "This is fucking mad." Because I can only understand what you've seen, right? And I've fucking travelled the world. I've been to many places, but I've never seen fucking proper mountains like that before. And the thought of you lot just going up and down them and up and down them. But even like after that first 40K, I think it was it 20K or 40K when we went down to the Thrill and saw you? I was like, how the fuck have they got here that quick? Like over that fucking ridge that we've just driven around. So, like, what would you say? I've got a client who's probably listening. She knows who she is, whose husband said to her the other day, just off the cuff, well, I quite fancy that Tour de Géant. And we were both like, what are you fucking talking about? What would you say to anybody that's considering entering this race, like from a reality perspective of how what this race is like?
So I would say, I mean, sure, if you want to give yourself like a 5 year, 10 year plan or whatever, then great. But I think a race like this is not, it's not a running race as we know it. You know, it's a race, it's about how well you manage yourself. It's about nutrition, it's about sleep, it's about how strong, you know, your legs are. I did a hell of a lot of strength and conditioning for this. Thank you, Big Paul. You know, whether you're confident on really difficult terrain, how well you can ascend, how well you can descend. There are probably like 20 moving parts that you need to work on. And yeah, great. If you've got all those in place, then go for it. That's what I say. But if you're, you know, the trajectory for this race is not, I don't want to be a snob about these things, but you've got to be realistic. The trajectory is not, you know, you do like a 50K or, and then you do like a few, like Centurion races, you know, and stuff like that. It's not the usual trajectory. You know, you need to have got your chops in the mountains. You know, I've been doing mountain races for like the last 15 years or so. You need to know what it's like to climb for 4 hours and not lose your mind. You need to know how your body's going to handle altitude. You need to know, you know, that your legs can take days and days and days of this stuff. So you know, I would say to anybody, like, yeah, go for it, but you're going to have to put in a hell of a lot of work, and that's probably going to take years to get to that point. This is the absolute hardest thing that I've done, you know. And I would never say to anyone like, oh yeah, go for it, mate, go for it. Oh, it's brutal, it's brutal, isn't it?
I think it's the only race I've ever watched where I'm like the word savage does come into it because it is just ascent after ascent after ascent after ascent. Like the map is fucking hilarious. The map of the elevation is hilarious because it goes on forever and it's just like up, down, up, down, up, down. And the downs aren't that much fun either because they fucking go on for ages and you're absolutely fucked and they're switchbacks, aren't they? So it's like, why can't I just go straight down? So I agree. I think that it's definitely a kind of. I mean, I don't actually think that I don't know how I feel about Tour de Géant, to be honest with you. I still feel like I didn't even run the fucking thing, and I'm still absorbing it, absorbing the experience. But massive congratulations, you're absolute legend. Everybody thinks it. Everybody knows it.
I think, I
Hey,
mean, one thing,
Kirsty, what's
what
next?
I was just going to say one thing to bear in mind. If it is something you want to do long term, the same race company do things like Grand Tour Courmayeur, or, you know, there's a 20K, there's 100K, there's 130K. You don't have to jump straight into Tour de Gion. In fact, I would say probably do one of those other ones first so that you understand what it's about.
I've got my eye on it. Is it Grand Trail?
Grand Tour Courmayeur,
Yeah, I think I might do that one because it looks quite good, and I do like Courmayeur. It's 80K, isn't it? And I reckon I can. And then that way, you're just like, oh, I actually, do like this or fuck that, which isn't bad at all. But one more thing before we go. Did you hear about the scandal at the front of the race?
Oh, right, the Francois Dane and stuff.
Oh, it's. There's a proper investigation that needs to be done, but I don't think me and Kirsty have got time to do it or the time
Well,
or the
this is our
shot.
last podcast.
I don't think it actually is. I think there's one more.
Oh,
So
is there?
you say
Shit.
that, but there's one more. So as Kirsty was running along, there was a scandal, and all of this is allegedly, but not allegedly because it did actually happen at the front of the race, right? So Francois Dane, renowned ultra runner, four-time UTMB champion, right? He's the front runner. He's a big man. He's like 6'3" or something. I think he's Team Salomon, and he had films being made about him. Everybody was like, he's so handsome. When I say everybody, I think I probably mean me. Everyone knows who he is. And it was a bit of a coup for them to have him because he's this big UTMB champion. Anyway, about a day into the race, this rumor starts to circulate that Martin Perrier, who is a Swiss runner, eventual third place finisher, has handed Francois a handwritten letter at some point during the race. And all these rumors were going around, like there's a video of Francois reading it. I'm like, how? How? They were running so fucking fast at the front. But there's this handwritten letter that Martin Perrier has given to Francois Daine, accusing him of cheating. And that letter contains the line, "I have proof that you have paces. If you don't quit by midnight, I'll release photos proving it." So you can only imagine how excited I got cursing about this alleged misdemeanor. And obviously, it got worse and worse, and that people were talking about it loads and loads and loads, and nothing happened. So, but there was lots of pictures of Francois allegedly being crewed, not at crew points. He had a lot of people with him because he had the camera crew with him, the Salomon camera crew, Salomon media team. There was a lot of his children were there, so they were like kind of running around him like little tiny beavers. And yeah, there was a lot of gossip about it. And then ultimately, at the end, Martin was uninvited from the finish the ceremony, so he was not allowed. He was asked not to attend the ceremony, and then had to issue and then issued a full statement apologizing for his behavior. But still, there is the unresolved, why did he write that letter? It is just very weird and just added a bit of excitement to the front of the race, if I'm quite honest with you.
I mean, it's one of those races where there's not a lot of rules. That you know, the rules are like you're all adults. There isn't like a big kit list or anything like that. And I think there are clear rules about where you can and can't be crewed. But I saw so much breaking of that.
I actually think there is one rule for the elite and one rule for everybody else. Now, there was a Romanian runner who was first. He was running first. And at the very start of the race, he was disqualified for being crewed in a bar. So apparently he nipped into a bar. Apparently his crew, so I've heard loads of different things about this, but his crew got there too early to set up at the crew point because he was running so quickly. So they set up in a bar nearby. And then he went into the bar. He was crewed by them. It was someone videoed it, fuck knows who videoed it, sent it to the organisers, and he was disqualified. But it's not even like there was a time penalty given to him or a warning. He was just disqualified. He was leading the race, right? That is weird. That's fucking weird. I think because he should have been given a warning. When you look at Francois had loads of people around him all of the time. And I know that they are his media team, but at the same time, they are running with him. And there were pictures on his Instagram that showed him being crewed or having rests at places that were not the crew stops. Plus, when I was with you, when I was waiting for you at various crew stops, we crewed you outside a crew station, outside a station, because there was no seats in there. So we sat down at Donas outside and did it there. There were people crewing from their vehicles outside Donas because there was nowhere to crew within the tent, right? So I felt like there was all eyes on the elite at the front. Having said that, I know other elites that had people coming and going to crew them, and then but then it, so it was all kind of very flexible. And the big rumor going around was that Francois was being protected because he was because he's this athlete, because he's like Mr. UTMB, because they wanted him to win, because they want him to come back, because they fucking love him, basically. So he's being protected. He's got like the mafia of the tour around him being like, "We will disqualify you. We will take you out the race. We'll take you out the race." There was another bit of drama when Benet, I can't remember what his second name is, but he was ahead of Francois and he got very sick at a refuge and they kept him there for like 5 or 6 hours. And some people were like, it was a Salomon doctor that kept him there so that Francois could get ahead. Like all of these rumors were like swirling around. It was so exciting. But I do feel like there was one rule for some people and another rule for others. Like almost like the people who make up the majority of the pack were kind of given a bit more flexibility on the crewing. Like, did you see people being crewed outside of crew stations?
Oh yeah, 100%, like all over the place. I think that James Elston said that that if you're kind of Italian, they'll turn a blind eye, but if you're not Italian at the sort of general level. But yeah, like everywhere I went, there were people with like carrier bags like in the street waiting for their runners, or people just like walking along with their runners and stuff. So yeah, it was absolutely rife.
There was a rule about pacing that you weren't allowed to run for more than 50 meters with someone. And I've read the rules so, because obviously, I work a lot with James at Centurion, so I'm very rule stickler. And even I was even like, you're only one crew person in the crew point. So I was like, we can't have more than one. But there were people with more than one. But I'm very sticklery. So while I was on the crew, I was like, it can only be one. We can only do this. And even when I can't see that because it's blurred.
It's the pass. You had to wear a pass.
Trailer assist. Yeah, you had to wear this pass with your crew
Yeah.
that says trailer assisted. And I was like, what the fuck does that mean? Apparently, a trailer is a trail runner. That's what it means. But me and Elise were in the first checkpoint with you, and I was like, only one of us can be in here because I'm terrified they're going to disqualify you because I'd heard about this Romanian guy being disqualified. That was never going to happen. Like, that was never going to happen. And I eventually worked that out. But at the same time, I don't want to be breaking the rules. And at the same time, I was like, we can only go to these refuges. We can't go to these other
Yeah.
ones. And also, even when we came to meet you at like Konya and like we were walking you in to the checkpoint, I was like, there's five of us walking you in. Are we pacing you? Are they going to say we're pacing you? Whereas Francois's got his adorable children running in and out of refuges with him. And I'm like, that's emotional support. It seems like the rules are very lax, but the rules are very lax. But then suddenly there's these like massive things that they've done, like get that guy out of the race, do this, do that, like issue an apology. You're not coming to the fucking, presentation. It's
Yeah.
just very
Yeah, it
interesting.
was a bit random. I mean, I much prefer the Shane Olley approach, which is the absolutely hard and fast rules for everybody, make it a fair race, particularly when it's such a hard race. Like, to me,
The
it's just
fact
like.
is, like, they give you everybody at the tour, their drop bags are all the same. It's a bit like Dragon's Back, isn't it? You have these silly yellow bags, so you can't have loads and loads of drop bag kit, but then you can have crew with fucking cars worth of kit. What,
Yeah.
basically, whatever. It's just mad. So, yeah, I thought, oh, this is a little bit Dragon's backing, but then it's like, no, it isn't. Maybe they should get Shane Olean as the race director. I think it would actually don't because he'll probably make it harder.
Yeah.
Yeah, too easy for Shane. Thanks for talking to us about it. It's been amazing. Have you? I know that you don't want to. That this is a stupid question, but after doing that, is there anything where you're like the next that I do have my eyes on this in like 10 years' time, or do you just need some time to suck in what you've done?
No, I need some time to suck in what I've done, but I think what it cemented for me was that I want to do more of these kind of adventures, but maybe not as racers, maybe just do it as personal adventures, like go and do some like refuge to refuge stuff, or go and do like one of the like European walking routes or something, just with a pack. I think that's probably where it's at for me. There were elements of it, I didn't like certain elements of the race and stuff. And
Are you saying you've completed ultra running?
no, 100% no.
Would you do the Barclay Marathons?
But at the same time, I find that whole like what are you going to do next annoying, because it's like I've just done this. It's
I
possibly the
know.
biggest thing I've ever done. Like,
I know, but I think it's a natural. I hate it as
oh
well, but I think
yeah.
it's a natural thing, isn't it? It's like the natural. It's like when you have a baby. I guess when you have a baby, they're like, oh, you can have another one. It's like, just fucking have one.
Yeah,
Like, it's
yeah,
ridiculous.
yeah. But it's like it doesn't always have to be harder, does it? Like, it doesn't always have to be like a harder race or a longer race or whatever. It can be something totally different. Like, what I do next might be, I don't know. I mean, I won't do this, but like, try and get my marathon PB down or something. Do you know what I mean? It's like you got to choose a personal challenge, and yeah, it doesn't. I hate that kind of ultra running thing where it's like, oh, you did 100 mile. Are we going to do a 200 miler? It's like, well, no, it's different skill sets. It's
It's
different
weird
things.
because, yeah, when I see things like that, I'm like, oh, should I put that, like, my list at the moment to finish for me to feel like I've got my chops, I got my like CV in order is finish Dragon's Back, do the Winter Spine. I feel like if I do those things, I don't know why, I feel like so I'm going to move up to the next level. It's ridiculous, but that's what being in this bubble has basically made me feel like. And then I'm like, then maybe I could think about Tour de Géant in 5 years' time. But I'm like, do you even fucking want to do Tour de Géant? Do you even want to do those races?
Yeah.
You can very easily get sucked into the I should do this rather than I want to do this.
Yeah.
And I had quite an interesting so the people one of the people you beat, John Kelly, who you did beat because you beat him. I was chatting to him about how I was like, is it the hardest race in the world? Like, as far as you're concerned, is it the hardest thing you have done? And he's made a really good point of saying, well, it depends on what you're good at, doesn't it?
Yeah,
But he
I
actually
agree.
said that he thinks the winter spine is harder because of the nature of the weather and the nature of the
Yeah.
time of year. Whereas I'm like, no, mate, this is like because you've got the weather and you've got the spikes. So it's all based around like your own perception and what you're good at and all that sort of stuff. But I think for me, this one is like the fear as well of like being on those scary spiky bits where it's very icy and very windy and you just don't know what's going to fucking happen, do you? You just don't know what you're going to get. Your race, for example, was very different to Damien's race because you had completely different weather, and that's something that you can't allow for, is it? Is it? You just have
No.
to fucking try and be as prepared as you can. So Yeah, it's all really interesting, but I hope you recover well, and we will be back in next. Sorry, but we will be back next month with
Okay.
an investigation, probably into France, Wild Terrain. I really want this to kick off, but I don't think it's going to kick off.
No.
I'm certainly not going to try and kick it off. I'm quite scared of Salamander. I'm scared they might come around my house in the night and stab me. Okay, I love you. Thank you. Bye bye.
Bye.